Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Delivering on the returns, increasing our margins.
Ratings go down the toilet if I'm not here.
All I do is simply put the math in my favor.
We agree that Brandon and John do good work.
The reason is simple wrestling economics.
I've been told the Netflix numbers. I've been told the metrics a little bit, probably five different times. I still don't get it.
There were respectable wrestling journalists who needed answers.
Thank you very much, members of the media. I hope you all go to hell.
How about we pop a number right here, right now?
Part of the show, man.
Welcome to Pollock and Thurston for Wednesday, September the 17th, as we go into a big head-to-head weekend as the WWE goes up against college football. I am John Pollock from Post Wrestling, joined by WrestleNomics' own Brandon Thurston, the man who is breaking news and writing opinion pieces at a feverish clip that you can find all across the wrestling world. How are you, Brandon?
I'm good. I am the foremost defender of WWE's relationship with Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. I appreciate you putting out that IQ test last week and 90% of the people that passed, but I'm here for the 10%. That's my entertainment for the week.
Let's have a journalistic discussion here. Was it clearly enough labeled as an opinion piece defending Saudi Arabia?
Yes, but to me, that's the genius of this, and I will use that term for your written piece, which again, people can go read Brandon's piece from last week. Don't make this. I hate politics. That's why I'm going to love WrestleMania in Saudi Arabia. Okay, now for anyone that listens to this show,
please don't make this political.
This title by Brandon Thurston. I think that the fact is that you could read this as one side defending this. I think that's the genius of it, is that you could take all of these existing arguments and put it to the side. And yes, you, the reader, we are placing some weight on your shoulders to be able to discern, although I think it is very, very clearly labeled. And personally, I think that if you come away with this, with the opposite of maybe Brandon's intent, I don't want to jump the gun here and put words in his mouth or his hand. I think that that's part of the appreciation I have of this, is that there is some left for you at the end to decipher. Okay, we're not going so cryptic like we're the series finale of The Sopranos here, but you can make your own conclusions.
We do challenging work here. We're content creators, and we create challenging content for our highly intelligent audience, and they consume it and they digest it. And what happens at that point is up to the audience member.
We don't serve pablum, okay? We're elitists. It's what we do, okay? That's what we do. It's what we do. All right, we have no time for chit-chat on this week's show. We're going to get right into things because there's a lot to cover. A little later on, we're going to be joined by Robert Jackman, who has been a guest on the show in the past, and he is going to be returning. He's a UK journalist and has done some work for The Uncrowned with Yahoo Sports, just writing about WWE's decision to go to Saudi Arabia in 2027 with WrestleMania. We'll be talking at length with Robert about that and his recent piece. We have the Crawford Canelo viewership statistics to go through, Paramount Skydance, that it's just an open ATM machine, one studio, not enough. Maybe we're going to get more. $1 billion up to in share repurchases for TKO. We have lots. A massive legal update from all corners of the legal front. We will be going through updates there. But let us start with the announcement that came last Friday afternoon, or should we say over a week ago on Snapchat, where exclusive members of Turkey Al Sheikh's followers could have gotten the scoop on this, as well
he
as
he said that it was one of his team members who accidentally put it out there.
Him on video on Snapchat, and then this Arabic press release that also went out. This was a very interesting week as Turkey Al Sheikh hit Las Vegas and was just this guy did not have any he just loves making announcements and on his timetable as well. So this press conference is called for Friday afternoon, and there is a Big Paul next to Turki Alşaik and this very threatening figure in the back who was working security detail, may or may not be one Mark Calaway, and flanked by Bianca Belair, Liv Morgan, Charlotte Flair, and others, and making the announcement that WrestleMania 43 will be going to Riyadh in 2027. No dates announced, no venue announced, but they are taking the WrestleMania over to Saudi Arabia. More importantly, no cost announced yet for what WWE is going to earn for staging.
Well, they wouldn't announce a cost, but as a fee, but we assume there are rumors out there that it could be as much as four times what the typical Saudi Arabia fee is, which is $50 million. It stands to reason it's going to be a lot more than $50 million.
If you're putting a conservative estimate in, I think $100 million is probably
two events. It's a two-day WrestleMania.
Certainly. Like you can certainly make that logic that you're getting two WrestleManias. The press release did include like SmackDown, Raw, NXT as being part of a traditional WrestleMania weekend. So, this is obviously going to be an enormous financial deal for WWE to take the event to Saudi Arabia. What did you think of just the rollout of this? Do we call it a press conference that went down on Friday? Because half of that statement is not accurate. This was a conference.
There were people at it. There were people at this conference. It was a conference is maybe what we should call it. Although there were more people at the conference involving Mark Shapiro at Goldman Sachs. No press were invited. We certainly were not invited to go to Las Vegas. But
are you sure? Did you check your junk folder?
I check my junk folder every now and then. Yeah.
Okay.
Not there. It looked like a press conference, but there were no media members there. Certainly no questions. Nobody got
I wanted the alternative angle so that we could see from the perspective of the people on stage.
Well, it was on the other
side. Were they talking into? Is this like at the Thunderdome when they had to do promos or that they staged the Hall of Fame inside the Thunderdome and they're talking to nobody?
This is the equivalent of an Oval Office address, I guess. There's, you know, you're making an address and you got to have a lot of people there, so you need a table. I hope members of the media get access to Turki Alşaik eventually and we can, you know, have a discussion with him.
I mean, this was only announced on Friday, so there was a...
Maybe we need it to be remote, so I don't know if we want to, you know, go to Saudi Arabia, but yeah.
So in the aftermath of this, there seems to be different reactions. There are those that have argued that this is WWE selling out. It's one
this
thing.
This is progress, right? This is WWE continuing the progress that they've already helped make in the kingdom. Pat McAfee loves it. It's been cool to watch. And you can't sit on the sidelines, as Paul Levesque said. You have to be a part of the change. And, you know, women can drive now. And we should definitely acknowledge that women can drive. I think they have the permission to initiate their own divorces, maybe, now. There are a lot of people who get jailed and even executed for criticizing the government, even mildly.
Well, let me just share this, that driven by the modernizing reforms of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia has been inching up the ranks of the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Index, now coming 126th out of 146 countries in its...
Do we know where they were before? Report.
Well, they're saying inching up, so that means they were below 126th. So that is by definition progress.
Yeah. So I feel like
this could take them into a top 100 nation.
I feel like we have to say this again and again and again. Okay. Why are you being so mean to Saudi Arabia? Why do you hate Saudi Arabia so much? Why don't you, all governments, Ari Emanuel said, he doesn't know why he gave money back. All governments do bad things. We can all go through our emotional ethics about it. So why aren't you critical of the US when WWE runs in the US? Why aren't you critical of Canada? I know you're biased in favor of Canada, aren't you? Why aren't you criticizing AEW for running in Toronto?
Well, trust me, I would much rather that the WWE and AEW never come here. It's a very big headache for me when they come to town. It throws my weekends off tremendously. My question would be this. Let's just simply, again, I have absolutely zero issue if they want to stage shows in any country in the world. But let's ask about other nations, whether it be the Middle East, whether it be other countries. Why doesn't WWE go there? Why doesn't WWE decide, like, we have this powerful wand that produces progress. Why don't we go to all these other different nations? Is it possible that this is simply a transactional choice that we wrap around in this coding of change and progress, and financials never make their way into that discussion? Like, let's just be clear. They are being paid ungodly amounts of money to go to this country. And the other side of the coin is, why is this country overspending so much for these events? What is...
They make it all back on ticket sales, right?
No, they do not. They do not make back any of this. This will...
But they do sell tickets.
This is... What the spending here is what every AEW critic has designed around Tony Khan. That it's like, this is not a real business. That it's just unlimited funds with no return on investment. And their cost is of no material objective when it comes to running a sound business.
It has a material objective. This is not Turkey Al Sheikh's vanity project. This is what they're getting. They're probably generating, I don't know, a few $100,000 in ticket sales, something like that. Let's say it's a couple million. Well, they're still, even in the typical PLEs that they pay $50 million for, they're still spending some $48 million that they're not recovering, or something like that. They're not recovering tens of millions of dollars immediately. But they clearly see it as a value to get a message out there about Saudi Arabia. The difference.
What's the message?
This is a normal country. This is a fine place to visit and to view as a normal country, because, you know, I think you look at some of the responses.
Wouldn't every country want to export that same message?
Yes, but they're not paying for it yet. The difference between every other W event, I think people, maybe most people at this point don't need it spelled out, but some people do. The difference is that the government is paying, and not just paying a little bit. Like, sometimes Las Vegas, you know, Visitors and Convention Authority pays to drive tourism, but they're paying a lot. They're paying $50 million. They're not paying $5 million like Las Vegas did, or even $7 million like New Jersey did for SummerSlam. They have been paying $50 million per event since 2018. Lord knows how much they're going to pay for WrestleMania, or Royal Rumble for that matter. I'm sure it's going to be a lot more than $50 million. It's probably going to be a lot more than $100 million. That's the difference. And if the only thing comparable, I'm just going to repeat what I said last week, I guess, but the only thing comparable to this in wrestling history that I can think of is Collision in Korea in 1995, wherefore, what do you know, an authoritarian regime, New Japan and WCW, went over there and got paid a lot of money to put on an event that helped spread a message and present an authoritarian regime as normal, or to glorify it. Other examples, now the what about the United States analogy goes when we're talking about the UFC's event that they're eventually going to do on the White House lawn to glorify the Trump administration.
Let me say, that event at the White House is going to get far more coverage of this regard than WrestleMania in Saudi Arabia is going to get. So for the whataboutism, let's talk about this next June when that event is coming. And I think there will be plenty of, just even if you're not talking about it from just a kind of a purpose of like moral superiority, just simply, what are your tax dollars involved in this staging of such a large scale live event?
Large scale international event. And let's say this too. Even let's say that Saudi Arabia is not a dictatorship. It's not, it doesn't have one of the worst human rights records in the world. Let's say it's just a sort of run of the mill, mostly free state where people can vote and people can write things and say things without being imprisoned or executed. If that sort of government were paying WWE tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars for events, that would still be weird. To run events out here that get broadcast around the world, that include things like putting video packages in the middle of events to talk about how great the leader of the country is, that would still be weird and questionable. But the fact that that government is not a a democratic state where people can vote and express themselves freely without being punished, where it's not a crime to be gay. The fact that in Saudi Arabia, you can't vote and you do get executed or imprisoned if you criticize the government openly, and that it is criminalized to be gay it's a problem to even be supportive of gay rights in Saudi Arabia. Well, that all makes it worse that WWE is doing this. And the fact that a lot of people do the same whataboutisms that Jonathan Kraft did was it the sports conference in Massachusetts that he sat next to Mark Shapiro for, that say, oh, what about things that we do? Who are we to sit in judgment of countries like Saudi Arabia who have human rights abuses? The United States does human rights abuses too, but the United States, except for UFC on the White House lawn, is not paying WWE or other organizations, except for UFC on the White House lawn, to run events that distract from the abuses that this government may be involved in. And the fact that so many people push back against the criticism of these events for authoritarian regimes tells you that the propaganda may be very expensive, but it does work.
I would say as well that the response to this, I think that this does strike a core with, like, beyond, say, like, our audience, where maybe we're going to cover this in a little bit more of a, like, regularity. But this is also taking the big landmark event of the year for a lot of wrestling fans, and it's not going to be accessible to most wrestling fans from a live perspective in 2027. So I think you're getting that kind of a response. It was noteworthy that they reiterated the announcement on SmackDown with the audio turned down so you couldn't hear the crowd. And then on later that night at Worlds Collide, they replayed the announcement as well, and we did see the video show up from the pavilion in Las Vegas, and there were catcalls for the announcement and a chant of "you sold out" at the arena.
It was booing. This was, you know, I saw on video.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then Monday, it was interesting because this didn't even strike me until one of our listeners brought it up afterwards, was there was no mention of this on Raw on Netflix, which was surprising to me that there wouldn't even be, like, some kind of announcement of the WrestleMania location that typically they'll just blanket on all of their programs when you're coming out of an announcement like this. So that's been the response so far. And we've also done some reach out to some promoters as well, specifically Mike Bocchicchio from High Spots and Brett Lauderdale from GCW. Now, you would think just on the surface, this is going to totally cut off the downstream effect that WrestleMania will have for non-WWE promoters. And what we learned was, first of all, Bocchicchio, who runs WrestleCon and High Spots, stated that it's highly unlikely that they would end up doing anything in Saudi Arabia, and more likely to pick a city in the U.S. and do something on our own. Not completely dismissing it, but again, highly unlikely. On the other hand, Brett Lauderdale tells us that he has already been approached by two organizations that stage events in the Middle East region who have offered to host GCW. He emphasized that with the 2027 WrestleMania 18 months away, it's too early to say whether such plans are realistic. But the fact that they have even been contacted, and maybe we'll get into this more with Robert, like, it brings about many, many logistical questions about doing something of that level in Saudi Arabia. And certainly to the point that many raise is GCW, that is very well known for one of its big shows, is Effie's Big Gay Brunch, that you would assume is not going to fly in Saudi Arabia.
One would think. And how do you say Mike's last name? Bocchicchio?
Bocchicchio, I think, Bocchicchio. Is how
he also told us that part of the reason, or at least the reason that he cited, was that it would become very expensive to take everybody overseas. Sure. To take his staff overseas. Talent tends to charge a premium when you book them for international events, and that it would just be, you know, more effective to run it, to run WrestleCon somewhere in the United States, in some city in the United States. Which raises to me the question, I think a lot of people have talked about it, is there an opportunity here for AEW to run some sort of event? Some people have said they should run head to head with WrestleMania at the same time in 2027. This is 18 months away here. But I do feel like there is, WWE in 2027 is sort of vacating that demand, assuming that, you know, the Collective and WrestleCon do not go to Riyadh. I do feel like WWE is sort of vacating the demand for, you know, the one big one time a year where there's big demand for wrestling fans to travel somewhere to see the big, you know, big brand event, and then to also see some indie events.
I certainly see an opportunity for AEW. I would not run that weekend. I think regardless of where WrestleMania
weekend.
No, I would not run the same weekend as WrestleMania. But if you're talking a week or two out, either on before or after, I'd be giving a lot of thought if there is a way that you could book New Orleans. I think it's the ultimate make good that AEW swoops in and, I mean, could stage something that is designed to be sort of a, hey, here is AEW that is paying back the wrestling industry, that is giving the audience their big wrestling festival at that time of the year when so many are, you know, it's a growing sentiment of fans that are feeling like, here, you're taking the big event away, you're pricing us out of the market, and you have no shame about stating your game plan in very public settings, and AEW can at least, you know, kind of play the good guy in this role should they want to. It's at least something I'd be kicking the tires on if I'm AEW and seeing, like, what opportunities do we have here? Because this WWE boom period, there haven't been too many weaknesses or doors left open. And we are seeing, like, some holes that AEW could potentially fill that, you know, TKO is opening up for AEW, potentially.
Yeah. I think it's an opportunity for AEW to brand itself. I mean, regardless of, I mean, if you run a pay-per-view, it's probably going to be profitable. But I think it is an opportunity for AEW to brand itself as the more fan-friendly company that's not going to... Well, Tony Khan did not rule out that he wouldn't take Sovereign Wealth when someone asked him in an interview. But it does give AEW the opportunity to brand itself as a more fan-friendly company that's not going to take its major events to Saudi Arabia for a government that's going to pay them an exorbitant fee. Combined with other issues like, you know, the complaints about ticket prices being really high.
Today, ESPN did hold a media call. Brandon, you are on the call. It was designed to promote WrestlePalooza that is coming up this Saturday, and this will be launching on the enhanced ESPN app that they have started to promote on WWE programming as of Monday.
The DTC app, the enhanced app, the ESPN Unlimited. I think those are all the same thing.
Yeah.
But that's not ESPN Plus. ESPN Plus, a different thing. Correct?
It's so confusing. Like, I understand all of these different services, but I have such sympathy for people that are tuning in on Saturday that have not done all this research ahead of time that are going to be totally lost in terms of what they are tuning into. And that seemed to be a recurring theme on this call, was the fact that just because you might have ESPN on your cable package, that does not ensure you're getting WrestlePalooza. In fact, you know, two of the major carriers in Comcast and YouTube TV, you are not going to have access to WrestlePalooza. And that represents over roughly 20 million cable subscribers.
I believe less than half of the U.S. universe. Of course, if you're not in the U.S., this isn't your problem. You're watching it on Netflix for the most part. But I have gone through, like, all the filings that are public for publicly traded cable and satellite and digital alternatives to cable. And we do know, right, that Charter, if you're a Charter Spectrum subscriber, like people here in the Buffalo area are, you will be able to authenticate into the ESPN app and watch WrestlePalooza. If you have DirecTV, actually, there's a caveat. No, it's only DirecTV Unlimited subscribers, which I think is their version of the digital alternative. So really, this pie chart where 14% of the universe, which is DirecTV, only a portion of those are getting access to WrestlePalooza. Hulu Live, which is owned by Disney, which owns ESPN, you do get access. Verizon Fios does get access. Fubo TV does get access. So we're talking about well over 50% of the universe then that's unaccounted for here. So even if you already get access to ESPN, if you're a Comcast subscriber, if you're like me, a YouTube TV subscriber, I did experiment on Monday night and I logged into the ESPN app on my Apple TV with my YouTube TV credentials. I got in. I could even stream Monday Night Football live. But I did ask ESPN and they said, no, there's nothing new there. That doesn't mean that you're going to be able to get access to WrestlePalooza. And everything that was said in this media conference today, which was a very good media conference, was consistent with that, that, you know, only the carriers that I just mentioned, Spectrum, DirecTV Unlimited only, Hulu Live, Verizon Fios, and Fubo TV, only those customers are automatically going to get access to this. But they did express, the ESPN executives on this call did express that they are trying to work this into the renewals, and that by the end of the year, going into 2026, hopefully everyone who already gets ESPN on their system will get access to the ESPN Unlimited app that will give them access to the WBPLEs without pay. Or you could just pay the extra $30 and you can watch this for free. If you're a cord cutter, you can just pay the $30 and watch this as part of that.
Yeah, but there's a reality where a significant portion of people may already be paying for ESPN on their cable service. And if they want to watch Russell Palooza, you will have to fork over an additional $30. Right.
Like me. Like if I get access to ESPN and all their ESPN channels through YouTube TV, but I'm not going to be able to watch Russell Palooza on the app just with my YouTube credentials. I'm going to have to pay $30 to watch Russell Palooza. Or you could probably figure out a way to pretend you're in a different country and watch it on Netflix.
I don't know how you would possibly do that. Where can technology take us? Other topics that were brought up besides the MPVDs, Sean Ross Sapp asked about scheduling this against All Out and kind of the positives and negatives of running the same day. And it's been interesting if you're really paying attention to some of the wording, because last week when Paul Levesque was on with Pat McAfee, I mean, he stated that ESPN gave us the date. And in this one, it felt very much like, well, you know, we compete against everything. Look at all the college football that's happening on Saturday, which is, I mean, something that every WWE show is going to be running against every single Saturday if they want to run a pay-per-view on that date. And I mean, they didn't even name AEW by name here, but stating the fact that, you know, essentially this is, you know, there's only so many Saturdays and there's tons of competition out there.
I think our own reporting can invalidate that, right? I'm looking, you and I reported on August 11th that WWE is adding a premium live event on September 20th that will go head-to-head with All Out. And by that time, they had announced the ESPN deal, but hadn't, it was 2 weeks later on the 20th that they announced that, oh, it's actually starting even earlier than expected. So they had this date. And according to the ESPN executives, who, by the way, on this call were John Lasker, who is the senior vice president overseeing ESPN Plus, and Matt Kenny, who is a vice president of programming and acquisitions. They said that WWE already had this date on the calendar.
Yeah, which, I mean, when you think about it, like part of this was that WWE had fulfilled their number of shows for the year to Peacock. So had they not been able to move this to ESPN, what was this going to be?
And again, I was told that it had nothing to do with the number of shows being fulfilled. It's not like Evolution is equivalent to Royal Rumble, which still would have been within the term under Peacock through March. It was a reworking of the deal in some form.
Right. I guess as well, you're just looking at, like, this is a show that it's, like, you had just run a PLE in Paris at the beginning of September. We've got the Australia show the second week of October. Like, this does feel like a show that has just been created to, you know, I'm not saying this is strictly to run against AEW, but I mean, the date to me is not anything that you can look at as some coincidence, when all we have to do is look at the roadmap of the past couple of months and how these shows have just magically appeared on the same date as AEW shows. And I think that's, you know, I don't think this is going to be the last one either, I would presume. Also brought up was John Elba, who did ask about ESPN having any potential requests of talent, and essentially asking about Brock Lesnar, who, while not a defendant in the Janelle Grant case, is named many, many times in that complaint. And I mean, in this one, that's a creative decision, and all creative decisions are made by WWE. They stress the importance of SportsCenter being on location in Indianapolis, and asked by the man here on this show, will the journalists at ESPN have independence covering WWE? And it was said, unequivocal yes, that is church and state.
Yes. On the Lesnar point, the gist of it I got was, no, ESPN did not specifically request Lesnar to be part of this show. that was my interpretation of the answer there. But yes, I also asked about, I try to get some clarity on what the timing will be of, let's say, Comcast and YouTube TV. And they didn't want to get into specifics about particular deals, but did say by the end of the year. And
they certainly didn't want to create any friction of this being like pressuring their YouTube TVs or Comcast into some kind of like they were very careful that they don't want to single out any carriers. They're working on these deals. And I don't think they wanted it to come out as like being combative to pressure these companies right. to adjusting their agreements.
And they're pushing the $30 per month will also get you a bundle that will be the ESPN Unlimited app as well as Hulu TV, regular Hulu, and Disney Plus. But yes, and I was interested to know if it, you know, they would at least say, and they did, that you know that ESPN's coverage of wrestling will continue to be independent regardless of this big financial relationship that now exists between ESPN and WWE. And they said emphatically, yes, as you said, church and state.
Church and state. Now it's time to welcome in our guest. He has been on the show in the past. He just wrote an article for The Uncrowned looking at WWE's announcement to send WrestleMania to Saudi Arabia in 2027. Robert Jackman is with us on the show. Robert, thanks a lot for
Hi, Robert.
Stopping by today.
Hi, me. Good to see you guys again. How are you?
We're doing well. So Friday's announcement comes, and this was certainly met with a lot of polarization when it came to the announcement. What did you take from the reaction, specifically starting with like just your WWE fan base? And you went into this a bit in the article in Uncrowned, but what do you sense several days later about how this has been met by the WWE consumer, many of whom like they base like their one big trip of the year around going to a WrestleMania domestically in the US.
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty clear and I'm sure you guys have covered this already. The reaction on YouTube was just a bombardment of, you know, you sold out, negative comments, all of this, you know, again, I guess you can query how representative are the kind of people that actually log onto YouTube to watch these things. You know, there's a crossover, are these very hardcore, but you know, I think if you took the sentiment, the temperature on social media that night, there was, yeah, I'm not sure I saw a single voice welcoming this decision, let's say. You know, there were a lot of accounts that seemingly were very unhappy to hear about it. So that was kind of our starting point, really. You know, I think, as you guys know, when you're writing about wrestling, you sort of want to be in tune with what's out there, and I think... Yeah, I mean, we were just going back and forth on Slack, being like, wow, this is not going down well with the fans. And I don't think things have changed in the 5 or so days since then.
Do you sense that this is very different from, for instance, like UFC going to Saudi Arabia? Obviously, like we had this Canelo fight with Terrence Crawford over the weekend that was presented by Riyadh Season. Like, do you sense a difference among the wrestling audience when it comes to this, or it at all surprising the reaction to it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me the big difference is that this is WrestleMania. You know, this is a sports entertainment product that culminates in one big annual event, and I think, you know, you can compare WWE to other things. You had UFC work in Gulf States. You know, you've got Formula One. You've got boxing matches. You've got the NBA having, I think, warm-up matches in Abu Dhabi. But this is the central event. You know, jewel in the crown, but it doesn't work for any reason. But like, this is the central event of the wrestling calendar. And I think for me, that's a surprise. You know, as someone that's always been very open-minded about the WWE-Saudi Arabia relationship, you know, who's come on this show, I think, and said some good things about it in the past, I still think this is very different, you know, to be taking WrestleMania to Riyadh, to be taking WrestleMania out of North America and having it over there. You know, I can see why, you know, I can see why, for example, this was getting coverage in the mainstream press, whereas I don't think, you know, an announcement of the Royal Rumble did. You know, this is the Super Bowl of wrestling. It's a cliche, but it's true.
And Robert, what do you make of, say... And we might have discussed this last time, but say Paul Levesque's interview that he did recently with Pat McAfee, where they discussed WWE being part of the change, you know, putting aside that they're getting $50 million per event and who knows what they're going to get for the WrestleMania and the Royal Rumble. is having these events or having other sports, big sports, sporting events in Saudi Arabia, is that having a genuine positive effect on the social environment and the human rights environment in the country?
Yeah, I think that there's, you know, and I think when you sort of speak to people that really know Saudi Arabia, well, I think it definitely reflects a change in that, you know, if you go back 10 years, like to public gatherings were pretty much unknown. You know, there was no history of people just kind of spontaneously coming together or coming together to watch an event. And I think when you started to see that press coverage around, for example, cinemas opening in Riyadh or, you know, pop musicians going, I think there was a real novelty of people being like, wow, we're all in one place to watch this thing. And I think you can see that, you know, when I went to Crown Jewel at the end of 2023, I mean, you know, what struck me was just how at home the crowd seemed at a wrestling show. You know, this is a deeply, I mean, conservative doesn't do it justice. You know, this is a country that had religious police on the streets until only a few years ago, you know, policing modesty dress code, stopping mixing of the sexes. And now you've got 20,000 people in a wrestling arena, booing, jeering, you know, jumping out of their seats, kind of really getting involved with it. And yeah, I think, like I said in my piece for Uncrowned, I think there's no doubt that this is part of a positive change in Saudi Arabia. You know, you can say, well, yeah, they're starting from a really, really low baseline, for sure. You know, go back 10 years and you're looking at one of the most repressive countries on earth. It's certainly not a democracy by any means. You know, it certainly doesn't have gender equality, but it's making massive strides and in the latter, not so much the former. You know, is WWE a driver of that? I mean, I think it goes hand in hand. It just couldn't have happened before, you know, and I think, yeah, you've got to be careful, I think, about giving them too much credit for that. But I genuinely think if there's one moment that stands out for me, it was that match a few years ago. I think it might have been Crown Jewel in 2022. When you had the five-way women's match, and remember that Rhea Ripley entrance where they had all these guys in dish dashers, like literally treating her like some kind of visiting royalty, like bowing to her. And I just thought, you know, out of everything WWE's done, I think if you were making like a CBS documentary about the transformation of Saudi Arabia, I would be trying to get that as B-roll. I think that's huge. You know, it's, you know, we like I say, there's a danger that when you listen to someone like Paul Levesque talking, you can almost, yeah, you can swallow the hype. But I think when you see things like that going on in a country where women couldn't drive 10 years ago, you know, couldn't go out without a male guardian, to see like a female superstar being greeted like that, that is a big deal. You know, you can't question that.
And so what do you make of, does the positive that WWE may be participating in, does that outweigh a negative, and is there a negative of sort of doing arguably, as we've said at the top here, propaganda for an authoritarian regime?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think what you can't get away from is Saudi Arabia wants people to see it differently. You know, they're going to be hosting the World Cup. They're becoming more involved in international affairs. They're taking stakes in public companies. You know, I don't doubt they're trying to like detoxify their image. I mean, is it propaganda? I don't know. I mean, I would say no. I was like, what exactly about it is, you know, I take a very strict definition of propaganda. For me, propaganda would be where you are helping someone cover up a lie about what's going on in the country. That's not what's happening here. It's helping Saudi Arabia clean up its image. But I think that's part of a, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that's part of like a genuine movement towards Saudi Arabia opening up. It needs to do that. It needs to bring an investment. You know, all of these things that don't really have anything to do with wrestling. But I do think WWE is part of a shift. You know, you can query whether they got in there too early, you know, whether they should have been stronger on things like the Khashoggi murder, you know, whether they should have been stronger on trying to get women on some of the earlier shows, you know, all of those kind of things. But I think if you're going to maintain a line that WWE shouldn't be working in Saudi Arabia, well, in that case, what's different about pro wrestling from Formula One, from boxing, you know, from soccer? Are we saying that, you know, that there's something fundamentally different about it? I don't see that. You know, I'm not trying to be overly relativist about this, but I think, you know, that's the sports media world, right?
I think it goes all the way back to, you could say, like 1974 with Ali Foreman and with Mobutu's Zaire. But I guess the argument would be then that well, for whatever social progress they are making in Saudi Arabia, having these events here, which broadcasts to the world on Netflix and Peacock, that this is a normal setting, and well, there may be some human rights abuses, but it instills in people that this is normal, and that it maybe it doesn't deserve the criticism and pushback that well human rights abuses should get. Is what do you make of that? That yeah, normalizes what is wrong.
Yeah. But I think for Saudi Arabia to get to where it wants to be, it can't hide away from that stuff. You know, there is no show on earth that could make people forget that this is a, you know, an autocratic monarchy, that this is a country where, you know, a particular interpretation of Islam has historically shaped day-to-day life. Like, people know that. It's so ingrained, I think, in the imagination that, you know, I just don't see what WWE could do, even if they wanted, like, to completely change how people see Saudi Arabia.
I don't know about that, Robert. I would say that when people are tuning into these shows, they are not tuning in with that kind of political slant or looking beyond. I think they're tuning in for 3 hours of entertainment, and I think many of them would be aware, like they know why these shows go there. They know that there's an enormous financial gain for WWE. But this is, you know, Paul Levesque standing next to an individual who has a wing of the jail nicknamed after him. I think that that is never something that is going to come to the forefront on a WWE broadcast and is going to be, you know, it's just it's not wanting to look under the stone or see how exactly the sausage is made for these big fights or these big wrestling events to take place here. And I don't think you're getting that level of awareness or care when people are tuning into this.
Yeah, maybe. But then I think people do care about this stuff anyway, right? And they're going to see it leading the news bulletins. You think when really awful stuff has happened in Saudi Arabia, like you go back. Was it 2016? I think there was kind of a spate of executions on New Year's Day, you know, and this stuff will lead the bulletins, right? Like, I think that, you know, allowing them to host a sports product, I don't know. I just see a distinction there. Like I say, I think the big risk for WWE is that things could change. You know, if some of those positive steps we've seen in recent years start going backwards, what do they do? You know, if the more Saudi Arabia is paying into WWE's coffers, the harder it is to walk away from this deal, you know. And I think this is one of the, if I were taking a long view on this, you think, well, the previous deal ran for 7 years, you know, this one is going to run probably for around the same. I mean, who knows where we're going to be in that time. I think that that's potentially a danger, that, you know, you're kind of holding yourself slightly hostage to what happens in Saudi Arabia. But yeah, we'll see.
You as well, you know, we look at, you know, there's very few details attached to WrestleMania. Like, we know it's 2027. What are the logistics of where you could see the events being run? Do you expect this to be a big stadium spectacle? And one of the evolutions we've seen is just in the crowds that they have attracted, that you alluded to, like, they have cultivated a lot of, you can see wrestling fans showing up to these. Do you feel this event is going to be kind of an exclusive event that is going to be like, are your just average Saudi Arabian wrestling fans going to be able to attend these shows in your estimation? Yeah. Because that's one of the criticisms on this side of the world, is just that it's been such a pricey ticket to be able to get into these shows.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is an interesting thing. For one, you know, like I've having been to a Saudi show, the shows are not expensive over there. You know, it's a country with a lot of oil wealth, but it's a country with 30 million people. You know, you look at, like, the per capita wealth, it's not that high. It's certainly not a US level. You know, you can normally get a ticket for these Saudi shows. I got a floor seat, I think, for Raw for about $20, you know, or really negligible price. So, I can see them carrying on with that. In terms of the stadium, I think it has to be. You know, I think the Saudis are going to think, well, they bought the rights to have WrestleMania, right? And there are certain metrics that get compared from one event to the other. And if we see the WrestleMania crowd dwindle to like 20,000, you know, Kingdom Arena, like that 20,000 for Crown Jewel looks great on television. You know, I think people that follow the product have an expectation for what a WrestleMania looks like. So I don't think that they can get away with not doing a big sort of 50,000 plus stadium. And that's going to be a challenge. Like I was looking at the history, you know, even some of the big boxing matches that have taken place out there recently, the Usyk fights, like they're not in front of 60,000 stadiums. So I think this is, you know, it's going to be a real challenge from my perspective, to get that kind of authentic WrestleMania, big crowd, you know, those panoramic shots you have at the beginning, you know, to do that purely on local fans. So my reading of the press conference, I'm just calling it a press conference, is overselling it. My reading about what took place on Las Vegas on Friday was that the Saudis are really seeing this as part of their tourism push. You notice that like, the first question, again, question is overselling it, but we know was about people traveling to Saudi Arabia to see this show. You know, my sort of finger in the air read on this is almost a sort of dry run for the Soccer World Cup, which is going to Saudi in 2034. You know, can you bring in tens of thousands of foreign tourists who have no connection to Saudi Arabia? You know, will they be willing to go there to go see WrestleMania? And I think that's a real challenge, because I think that is what Saudi Arabia are going to want to see on a bigger level, is a successful tourism event. I don't think that's ever happened in the history of the WWE Saudi partnership. You know, I spent a weekend in Riyadh ahead of Crown Jewel. There were a lot of enthusiastic fans there. 90-something% of them were Gulf Arabs, you know, Saudis, Emiratis, Omanis. I saw very few people that appeared. You know, there were some North Americans working there, some of whom I chatted to were just completely out of tune with the product, you know, but I guess when you live and work in Saudi Arabia, there's not really that much on, so you kind of jump at what there is. I met some fans from Russia that told me they'd gone there because it was easier than going to Germany because of the climate during the Ukraine war, getting a visa, etc. You know, if that's representative of your Western fans, sort of working expats and a few people flying from Moscow, you've got a problem. So, you know, I think where are you going to get 20,000, 30,000 potentially foreign fans from? That's going to, you know, I think that's the big challenge, and that's what they're going to want to see WWE doing. And I think that's a pretty unenviable situation to be in for all of that, you know, small violins and all that. But like, you know, maybe they can pull it off, but I think that's going to be a challenge.
And just looking at where events have been for WWE and Saudi Arabia in the past, the first event, the Greatest Royal Rumble in 2018, was in King Abdullah Sports City Stadium. But that is in Jeddah, not Riyadh, where they have said WrestleMania will take place.
Yeah, there's King Fahd Stadium in Riyadh, which I think is around the same size, and where WWE has worked for. I mean, it's hard to say, but you know, looking at those older shows, those kind of 2018, 2019...
Yeah, Crown Jewel 2018 was in King Saud University Stadium.
Yeah. Very flat atmosphere at some of those shows, you know. And I get the sense they might have fallen into the trap that you see sometimes in that part of the world where you just basically give lots of locals free tickets. I went to a soccer match in Qatar a few years ago, which is a preview for the Soccer World Cup. And that they'd very much done this. They'd filled a stadium with people that just spent a lot of their time on TikTok or left at halftime, you know. I think that was the vibe I got from those early shows. Maybe, you know, I think when you look at the crowd now, they seem like genuine fans, they're loud, but hey, there's only 20,000 of them. Like I say, the challenge is going to be filling that stadium, giving it that WrestleMania feel. I mean, I guess the good news is if you are a European North American fan, you're probably looking at the cheapest WrestleMania ticket you'll ever see in your lifetime. Yes, there's going to be a $600 flight or whatever to get there. But, you know, I guess that's one plus side.
Maybe that's how you market it to the U.S. fans. Hey, folks, the cheapest WrestleMania ever. Just get on a flight. Yeah. There you go.
I mean, because I just don't see how you work around that. Because, like I say, the market pricing they do for Saudi events is so much below the North American and the European pricing. I mean, you can't possibly price separately for two markets or something like that. I don't know. I think that's going to be one of my nerdy questions, really, is, yeah, how much are they actually going to price these tickets? How are they going to market them? Yeah, because I think it'll be very different from what we're used to.
Wrapping things up here, when you look at just WrestleMania as a whole, and certainly this is going to most likely, I think, be the ceiling of what they can command by putting a WrestleMania in a foreign country. But like, can you see a scenario where it becomes like a very small pool of locations that WrestleMania cycles between, from your Vegas and Saudi Arabia's, that it's not going to be a new place every year, and it's going to be, you know, kind of just like a very small number of locations where they can maximize their fees to take it there?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's what you've seen with Vegas, and I mean, some of the reporting you guys have done around the tax credits they've been getting there. I mean, you know, knowing Vegas quite well, I sometimes wonder whether they'll even try put something kind of on the ground there, a bit like the WWE experience in Riyadh. You know, I could see them working that. But then you've also got these deals. I was saying to someone the other day, you know, I think someone I feel sorry for in all of this is Indianapolis. Didn't they famously ink like the first of these big deals to host all of the big events, you know?
Presumably. Yeah, I was going to interject that Indianapolis has, they at least announced a deal. Now, I don't know if this is something that they're bound to in writing, but they did announce the deal that came along with Royal Rumble, which has already happened in Indianapolis, to include a WrestleMania. They canceled the New Orleans WrestleMania and have, at least in words, promised them a future WrestleMania.
Yeah.
And future, that could be any time. They could get WrestleMania 100 for all we know.
Yeah, but if we even take them at their word on both of those things, you know, we're potentially looking at 2030 being the next Mania to be allocated. But I just think, yeah, the game has changed. You know, this is so many people have been like this kind of TKO-ification. I think if you are a sort of mid-tier American city, I don't know, you know, if you're someone like San Diego and you're looking to host WrestleMania, I mean, yeah, I think it could get to a point where if you're not, you're either going to have to do something like, you know, Vegas, throw a lot of money, a lot of tax credits, or you're going to have to ink one of these deals where you might pay slightly less for Mania, but you also have to compulsory purchase, you know, a Rumble, a SummerSlam, a Money in the Bank, a Survivor Series. You know, they're just, the game has changing. I think the entry point now to a US city to hosting a major WWE event is just getting higher and higher. And that's the question.
I like the sound of that.
Yes, Mark will have lots to say about this. Robert, it's always great to chat with you, and you just have such a great knowledge base, especially when it comes to combat sports in Saudi Arabia. So I'm sure we will be having you back on in the months to come.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping to be at the Rumble in Riyadh, so we'll see how that goes.
All right, you can check out his work at Uncrowned and anywhere else you would like to direct people to, Robert.
No, I mean, unless you're interested in reading about my travel journalism and British politics, yeah, I'd say maybe stick to Uncrowned, which is the wrestling part of Yahoo Sports. We have a lot of great content up there, which if you like this show, you'll love it.
All right. Thanks so much, Robert, for joining us. We really appreciate the time.
Thanks a lot.
All right. That was Robert Jackman joining us as we will be likely discussing WrestleMania in Saudi Arabia extensively. Are you going to the Royal Rumble in January?
In Riyadh?
Yeah, no.
We have discussed that offline.
We actually have. don't laugh, everybody. Okay.
It's as Mike. Sorry, say his last name for me again. High Mike. Spots, Mike.
Oh, Mike Bokicchio.
Bokicchio, as Mike Bokicchio said about WrestleCon, it's looking unlikely. No, I did look into it, and I think the likelihood that I would be allowed in the country is not for certain, but.
Well, we're going to follow over and kind of keep it on this topic because Turkey Al Sheikh was all over Las Vegas this past week, as some have dubbed it now, Turkey-O. He was, you know, front and center, and we got to see him and Dana White together. And if you tuned into the press conference last week, following our Snapchat press release debacle, we got this ending the presser between Terrence Crawford and Canelo Alvarez.
There is big surprise from Dana White. He will announce it now.
Thanks for coming out tonight, everybody. We appreciate it. We're going to face these guys off for photo ops. We'll see you at the weigh-ins.
What was the announcement? Did you play the wrong clip?
No, that was the announcement. We're going to face these guys off right now. I mean, Dana completely no-sold this and then just whispered to Turkey whatever this announcement was going to be that we never got. So, I mean, it got into the discussion, you know, several months ago, as we talked about on the show. You remember that Turkey had posted that Sella would be the promoter of the event, and that led to the discussion, is Dana White being removed from this? I mean, there was a lot of conjecture about what exactly the whole behind-the-scenes relationship was between Turkey and Dana White. So a promoter, Eddie Hearn from Matchroom Boxing, he's the chairman, has worked extensively with Turkey Alshaikh, has a pretty good relationship with Dana White, and he was on the Ariel Helwani show this week, and he was asked about working with Turkey and the potential conflicts that Dana and Turkey could arrive at, given his own history of working with Turkey.
Do you think they'll be able to coexist?
Who?
Turkey and Dana.
Working with Turkey Alshaikh is a wild ride. Dana works at a high level with Mark Shapiro, Nick Khan, all these people. I mean, they're very, very good at what they do, very smart. But they also like to do what they do and what they want to do. And Turkey Alshaikh, I'm just being straight, he doesn't really allow you to do what you want to do. He does what he wants to do and you follow. He's definitely not an idiot. He's a very smart guy. And there's a method to the madness. But the traditional ways of going on sale through tickets or announcing the press conference or even announcing the fight is just not the traditional way with him. And I think they're going to clash. But money's money, isn't it? I mean, you know, it depends if sometimes you're prepared to keep your mouth quiet and do as you're told. I am. You know, I feel like sometimes I know what side my bread's buttered on. You know, and I'm not too proud to say sometimes I will do as I'm told with these guys because it's a massive opportunity for my fighters, for the sport, and for our business. It's different. It's very, very different. It's fun. It's tiring. You know, I mean, when you wake up in the morning at 4 o'clock in the morning and you've got 6 missed calls from Turkey and 3 text messages going, why aren't you picking up the phone? It's not for everybody.
That was Eddie Hearn. I think a great insight into working with Turkey Alshaikh, which it sounds like I think Nick Khan could really get along with this guy because it sounds like Vince McMahon would not be too many steps away from the kind of mindset that those two would have. But I think it's a very like Turkey is the one at the end of the day that is calling all of these shots. And one more clip here as we talk about knowing where your bread is buttered and how to just accept that, we go to the host of the press conference. And this one kind of pains me because I am a big fan of Max Kellerman, great boxing analyst. And he was brought in to be front and center at this fight over the weekend. And here is Max Kellerman.
The people bringing you this present love boxing. Let me start with His Excellency, Turkey Alshaikh. Let me start with him, because if he's never born, none of us are here right now. This was his idea. And then Dana White. Dana White is the greatest combat sports promoter in my lifetime. He built an institution. You know why? Boxing's not as popular as it used to be anymore, right? UFC is really popular. That's because of Dana White. He built something like the NBA. Stop now, because he's about to do it for boxing again. For boxing now. You want an NBA or an NFL in boxing? Here it comes. Because he knows how to build an institution. And how do you do that?
Hey, Max. Boxing is always bigger, bigger and big. Don't say boxing is not big enough. Boxing is big. You know how big is boxing.
Yeah, that was Canelo cutting off Max Kellerman, who, I mean, we were having a discussion earlier about the definition of propaganda. I think Max Kellerman just provided us with said definition. But yeah, this was a wild week when it came to everything involving Turkey, Dana White, and this Canelo Crawford fight on Netflix.
Yes, I did turn this on for a moment on Netflix on, what was it? Was it Friday night or Saturday night?
It was on Saturday. No buffering issues this time around. I mean, this was a clean broadcast. Long broadcast, but a clean one.
I did tune in long enough to see Dana White enjoying the night.
Oh, yeah. This is Dana's happy face. I mean, look at him. He just looks like he's having the time of his life at this event ringside.
He's seated next to, and in like they're directly opposite the hard cam. you know, like in WWE, it's, you know, they're focused on the ring, and right across the hard cam, there's Turkey and Dana White. Mr. Beast is over here, right? Who's this individual between Turkey and Mr. Beast?
That would be one Jason Statham.
Okay. Tells you how much I know about the world.
What a dinner for four that would be.
Yes.
So the main takeaways from this is we had the Canelo Crawford fight, it peaked. This is according to Netflix and using the service Video Amp that Brandon will give us some context on what exactly is Video Amp, peaked at over 24 million concurrent streams, with the main event scoring an estimated average minute audience of 36.6 million live plus same day viewers from opening to closing bell. Now, take into account this fight, it was the walkouts were supposed to be around 11 p.m. Eastern time. This fight didn't start till 12:55.
I mean, yeah, I didn't see the main event. I was not watching the main event.
I think it certainly hurt them dramatically that they went so late, especially for like the East Coast viewers, which make up a significant part of the U.S. audience. The bout, they did announce a gate of just over $47 million. So the viewership paled in comparison to Tyson and Paul, but their gate, I think Paul and Tyson was like an $18 million gate to compare. So this was the third largest gate in boxing history behind Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao at $72 million and Mayweather Conor McGregor $55 million in the summer of 2017. A number of takeaways from this, but yeah, I mean, in terms of the viewership, I would say like this is probably what many people realistically had as I still look at this as a very successful number, even not at the scale of Tyson and Jake Paul. But this was, I think, overall received a whole lot better than Tyson and Paul was, which I don't know how many times you could do kind of a stunt fight like that with Mike Tyson versus this. It felt like they were really solidifying like a boxing presence on Netflix and, you know, with two of the top fighters of this generation as well.
So this did in the Tudum chart. The Tudum chart is different from Tudum is different from what they put in the press release, but it's not necessarily inconsistent.
This is weighing the entire 5-hour broadcast as well. That started at 9 p.m.
Is it because they put varies in the runtime? So
yeah, I don't know how they break this down. I assume this is. It's hard to imagine there were 17 million views for this entire 5+ hour broadcast that however they arrive at this number, because we don't have a length here. Yeah.
Right. So this is by the same measure that we measure Raw at, which in this week for the September 8th episode did 2.6 million global views, which is a reflection of accounts, not people. So while Raw did 2.6 million in the whole week, in fact, Canelo Crawford, in just 2 days, right, did 17.7 million, which is, to put that in some context, Tyson Paul, which was probably also a Saturday night, did...
It was a Friday, actually.
It was a Friday. So they had one more day. I doubt that makes too much of a difference. Did 46.6 million to Canelo Crawford, 17.7. So people want to see Mike Tyson fight and Jake Paul fight. Are they going to do a Logan Paul match? Is that still happening?
Jake Paul is fighting Tank Davis in a few weeks, and then they've at least, I mean, it was a very vague press release that Floyd Mayweather and Mike Tyson will have some kind of fight next spring without any details attached to it, and including no broadcaster as well, but nothing involving Logan Paul yet, although he was shown on the broadcast. We had several TKO crossovers at the boxing fight on Saturday, including Paul and Stephanie and others.
Yes, Angel Reese was there. What is Video Amp? Video Amp is a Nielsen alternative. Netflix not doing business with Nielsen, which I'm sure you know there are some sports TV executives who are not happy about that. But 36.6 million live same day United States watched just the main event. So they're capturing apparently just the, you know, when the main event started and ended. That average, according to Video Amp, which tends to be a little bit more generous than Nielsen, is 36.6 million viewers, which is a lot. That's like a big NFL game, right?
Yeah, I mean, this was number one globally. It was number one in, I think, 14 countries. Like this did really successful for them. And I think the production was very, very strong as well. Like this was one where I feel that I thought this was like overall like a big win for Netflix on Saturday from those that came away with it. It's like the biggest complaint to me that I heard was just the length of the show to get to the main event and outside of the booth, a lot of glazing on behalf of Max Kellerman. But I mean, minor things, I guess, in comparison. I think a lot of people came away like it was a great fight and you got to see, you know, just kind of a state-of-the-art production from Netflix. And I think the viewership, I think you'd be really happy with that. Like, this is kind of the top end of what a non kind of gimmick fight is going to draw. And quite frankly, like, you take out a Tyson curiosity, I don't know if like any other gimmick fights are going to do that level when you take out a Mike Tyson from the equation that just seems to have this mystique among an audience, regardless of age.
Yeah.
So the week was just a great one for Dana White. He was in a happy mood all week. This press conference, which sounds like it was the press conference to attend this past week. So a reporter, Sean Zittel, was given the mic and he wanted to talk about the Muhammad Ali Reform Act.
Not so my question to you is, why then do you want to make sweeping changes to the Muhammad Ali Reform Act that is meant to protect fighters to bring about a business model that currently has your company already paid out $375 million in antitrust lawsuits and has two potential pending class action lawsuits on the way as well?
Well, this is obviously a long discussion. If you want to talk to me about that, set up an interview. This isn't about me and my business. It's about these two guys on Saturday night.
If TKO can't make those changes to the Ali Act, will you still invest in the sport of boxing? Will you compete in the market?
Listen, if you want to be an asshole, let's do it in private and we can do an interview.
Yes or no?
If you want a showboat, I get it. If you have questions for these two that are fighting on Saturday, that's a different story.
I will say this. Dana White gets out everything that I imagine is going on in Paul Levesque's head during some of those press conferences. So, I mean, only he has a filter. Dana came off so poorly in this exchange. You could even hear the boos. The boos were for Dana. I mean, I'm sure there were
some.
How
do you know?
Well, I'm sure there were some for the reporter, too. Don't get me wrong. But I think this was like quite the pivot. But let's remain objective and see if Dana does give this a one-on-one interview to discuss fighter pay at a later time. But to me, you're at a boxing press conference. You're at the very first Zuffa boxing stage event with new promoter Dana White. This was completely inbounds when it came to a topic to discuss, even at the risk of ruining the mood, which, you know, sometimes we've been accused of. But I mean, I think the mood was adjusted here by Dana White, not so much Sean Zittel here, but I thought a great job.
Yeah, there's never been anything close to that fiery of an exchange at a W press conference.
Well, there's always time. We're going to stay on the Netflix front because today a Mark Shapiro interview dropped where my world comes to a halt. And for 45 minutes, we heard Mark Shapiro on The Varsity with John Oren. And one specific topic both of us found really interesting was Shapiro talking about the recent set of negotiations for the UFC's rights and how close they were to getting a deal with Netflix across the finish line and why that ultimately did not happen, with all of the UFC rights going to Paramount and Skydance.
There was one moment of disappointment, and that was when we were getting pretty close with Netflix, frankly, and they kind of stood by the fact that they didn't want to have the volume, which we understood from the get-go. And Ted and Bella were very upfront with that. We're looking for big events. So the fact that you could give us one pay-per-view, which, you know, they were just going to put on the platform for free, as long as you have you're a subscriber, as long as you just give us that, we're in and we'll pay premium for it. But we don't want to carry the other 30 fight nights. And over the course of conversations, they really didn't come off of that. And that's what opened the door.
You know what confuses me about that is that they have Raw. They have volume. They have Raw once a week. Didn't that convince them like, we can do a little bit more volume?
No, I think that played against us. I think they felt like we have volume there. Therefore, we don't need it here.
That was Mark Shapiro discussing volume and how close they came with Netflix. I thought that was a really interesting answer because one of the talking points we often hear about is that, you know, you bid on UFC, WWE. These are not the same audiences. And I took this answer as one where Netflix does see this as fulfilling one without needing the other. I don't know. What did you take from this?
Maybe demographically that makes sense, but it's not the same people. There's some overlap, of course. John Pollock, but that's about it, you know, right?
Yeah, I think that this is one. I mean, it certainly is. Like, I always look at Netflix that it seems like their model is so much more catered toward going after WWE's PLEs rather than, like, it just doesn't seem as though the weekly destination is necessarily what they want. But I mean, it's obviously the fight nights were not that attractive. They wanted the pay-per-views, and I would imagine that had Paramount not come, which we'll talk about in a minute, with just this incredible offer, I don't know how many places would have necessarily wanted everything. Mark Shapiro basically said, like, we were gonna have to chop this up to reach our price point, but it didn't seem like anyone outside of Paramount wanted to go all in for every event.
I guess it's consistent with, look, Netflix didn't take the US PLE rights. They already have Raw. Maybe they don't need that content to capture what's going to be largely the same audience. Maybe they didn't want the fight nights to capture the people that they would have already gotten if they paid for the numbered pay-per-views. So,
which I wouldn't disagree with. Like, I would only want the pay-per-views as well. Like, the fight nights are nice, but I don't think they're
going to need bigger viewership if they're on the same level of paywall.
Yeah. So, he was also asked about, you know, we don't want to be on five different places if we don't have to, but
we have great partnerships.
We will. And then they kind of went through the WWE inventory, and it's like, yeah, you basically need to have like four different services to keep up with WWE programming when you include CW. Mm-hmm. So there you go. That was the latest from Mark Shapiro. I don't think anything made the soundbite wall for us from this one. I might have to go back and re-listen.
We'll review it later.
Yeah. Shapiro did have quite a busy week. He was also at the Goldman Sachs conference, and I guess the big point that came out of this was ticket yield. What are Mark Shapiro's thoughts? He does agree there is a problem with the pricing on WWE tickets, so everyone can exhale.
Now, WWE is not where the UFC is yet, as you know, on ticket yield. We have our work to do there. We know we have a lot of room there because Vince McMahon was primarily pricing tickets for families and wasn't totally focused on maxing the opportunity there. And now that we've seen what we can do with UFC, we're replicating that in terms of ticket yield and holding back and advanced sales when it comes to on location on the WWE side. And it's really working out well.
It's going really well. And he's right. I mean, look, I can pull up the WrestleTix chart where I'm averaging their attendances over time. And there's you know, people are complaining left and right about how high ticket prices are, but the demand is not going down.
Like, I mean, it's a cold dose of reality for a lot of fans, but there is no reason for WWE to shy away from this very aggressive pricing strategy when the market is meeting the increased pricing that they are mapping their tickets out. Like, that is, you have to respond to the market. And quite frankly,
the marketplace is frothy.
It's frothy to the brim. And quite frankly, if you think that Vince McMahon in this situation would lower ticket prices, stating, you know what, these are just too large, I'm sorry, but your painting of a sainthood of Vince McMahon is a little bit exaggerated as well.
Is there, so I guess there's a PR question here. Should he be more mindful of the rabidity of the wrestling aggregators who did aggregate this? I saw it did make Reddit, which is sort of the barometer to me, that, you know, when you go to these conferences where you're ostensibly speaking to investors, that you should be mindful that the wrestling fan is going to get wind of this too, and maybe say it in a different way that doesn't make it so aggregatable. Or is that those people don't matter anyway?
I mean, I hate to be like the glass half empty, but I think more towards the latter. I mean, I don't think it's, I think Mark Shapiro, especially at this stage of being specifically in WWE business, understands that there is a level of focus on what they say that's probably a higher degree. Like, I'm sure there's many that would look like, how much, like, beyond yourself in 2018 was listening to all of the George Barrios fireside chats? Like, it was a very small amount, even by like wrestling sites that were necessarily covering those, that it was almost like this is a whole separate forum and audience we're speaking to that doesn't, there's a very small crossover in that Venn diagram. And, you know, today this stuff is going to get out, but at the same time, it's like, if you are somebody that has been so priced out of going to a WWE show, like, yes, they want you as a fan, but they are not marketing to you. They are not selling to you. You can be a fan by watching on television, and quite frankly, a lot of you will still watch. And I think that that kind of has bared itself out, that this is an audience that will take this and they'll continue to watch even if they're priced out. Like, they are not coveting you, the fan, if you cannot, if you're not this tall to get onto the ride.
As a listener pointed out to me, I think today, we need to do some research and find the data, but it could just be, and I think it's pretty likely that WWE's ticket prices are just sort of meeting the median, whereas they were probably one of the cheaper tickets in entertainment, let's say before the pandemic, and after the pandemic, it seems like ticket prices on the whole have gone up. And what TKO is doing, what Mark Shapiro's ruthless capitalism is doing, is getting them more up to an appropriate price.
This is not a WWE thing. Like, this is not WWE on an island doing this. I mean, this is a lot of live entertainment that post-pandemic, these have become very coveted, like live in-person concerts, sporting events. They have a higher value and you have an audience that is ready to spend for them. And that's who you're going to direct them toward. So Paramount and Skydance appear to be preparing a bid to buy all of Warner Brothers Discovery. Diminished cable assets and all. Throw everything from the junk pile and the assets, put it all into a bin, and David Ellison is willing to take it all in. The Wall Street Journal, I have not seen a follow-up article. What about AEW?
What does this mean?
I almost think we should rename this podcast. What does this mean for AEW? That'd be a great name for a show.
I got DMs as soon as the story came out. Yes. What does this mean for AEW?
You know what? If everyone is being honest, no one knows a goddamn clue. Okay? This bid has not even been submitted yet, much less what this is going to mean. I don't think that AEW has crossed the mind of David Ellison. So I think all you're going to get is guesswork, complete guesswork in terms of what this means. Obviously, this is a more massive story of just, you know, consolidating like two major studios and what this means on a giant level. It also does as well tell you about some of the most powerful figures in the world that rotate on Dana White's orbit, from Donald Trump to David Ellison to Turkey Al-Sheikh and Elon Musk. Like, these are all people that are attending these events and are all in that. He's on the board of Meta. Like, it does tell you the level of power and powerful figures that we are talking about, and how specifically to UFC there are very, very intrinsic ties with. It's a good time to be in business with David Ellison, is what I'm saying, and UFC is all in with Paramount.
I guess from a conspiratorial or antitrust aspect, you would think that, well, look, UFC, and that is TKO, has a great new deal with Paramount. Maybe they can pressure WBD to not continue carrying a competitor. That would be legally problematic if they did that explicitly. But maybe there's some influence to be had there. I think the other thing that people get at is we've all got post-WCW anxiety, and we know that there was a merger involved with Turner Networks, and then WCW went out of business. And I don't know. I mean, the networks, I mean, TBS and TNT, I see no reason why those would cease to exist, even if they were an asset that was part of a merger, which they probably will be eventually. Whether or not this particular deal is the deal that is finalized, we're a long way from there. And even in this Wall Street Journal report, there's discussion of how this is an early bid to try to get ahead of what could be bids from big players, maybe like Amazon and Apple.
So I'm sure we'll continue to follow this, and maybe we'll get an update on a future edition of Collision. They'll let us know what this all means for AEW. Hopefully. Let's race through a couple of stories here. So TKO has announced up to $1 billion in share repurchases. This did result in a boost for the stock temporarily on Monday. Essentially what this is they are buying back a significant portion of its stock and, you know, making their stock, it was in very high demand on Monday, as it's now trading at record levels. I think the peak on Monday was around $212, somewhere in that range. It's now at just over $202.
Yes. What is this about? Is this about TKO going private? No, no, it's, this was expected. You know, I think of, you know, look, we're not necessarily giving employees who are performing well the raises that they would have expected pre-merger, according to my reporting back in, I believe, March or so, or a few months ago. Ticket prices are way up. Employee benefits that they're used to are not there for W employees. But it's a great time to be a shareholder, because shareholder value is our most important ethical value in modern life. And this is something that they talked about ahead of this announcement, that they not only doubled the dividend recently, but they're also buying their own stock, which just increases the demand for that stock and in theory raises the price of the stock. So it's great to be a shareholder, I guess.
Here's an idea. I mean, it's an eat what you kill world.
Here's an idea. Maybe if you want to be able to afford W ticket prices, we'll just invest in TKO stock and then maybe you can afford that. I do not hold any positions in TKO stock.
That's getting to the front of the line for tickets, is like you're going to make a big stock sale of TKO to invest in WrestleMania tickets. I think that's where things are going.
And hey, look, if you have been holding the stock for a long time, this has been, you know, way overperforming the indexes. It's been doing really, really well.
Are you telling me that the TKO executives could make out like bandits right now if they wanted to unload?
I think they may have stock options. We've seen Nikon make some expected and planned selling of his shares. So he's certainly doing very well.
We'll get to our legal corner in just a second, but CMLL will run its anniversary card this Friday night, and it's going to be on CMLL's YouTube channel if you subscribe at the highest tier. But also added is it will be available apparently in English and in Spanish on Triller TV this coming Friday night. So if you want to just buy this card, I have no idea, but that's probably important to know. But there have been no names released yet. But this is going to feature MJF and Mystico in a title versus mask match happening Friday night. So this is, I believe this is the first time that a CMLL card has ever been available on Triller, and with English commentary, no less. So I'm curious.
Is Triller out, or is AAA out of working with Triller? Because they'd worked with Triller or Fight in the past, right?
Yeah, I mean, none of these recent cards have been on Triller. They haven't been on there for a while, so I would assume that deal has.
And that's just been on like WWE's YouTube channel instead, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. All right, let's get to some of these legal updates, and we'll do our best to go through all of these. Our favorite case that we're following, of course, is the ongoing Nick Bollea and Terry McCoy. Let's officially give Terry McCoy his proper title as the curator of the estate of Terry Jean Bollea, as he was officially granted by Judge Pamela Campbell last week. So now we have a curator of the estate to answer one of the issues that Waltz Films, who are the producers of the critically acclaimed Video Killed the Radio Star documentary that came out 3 hours and 10 minutes worth last Friday night, that Bubba has promoted, the number one documentary in the world. And I don't know, is this topped the Charlie Sheen documentary on Netflix? I would be curious to know. And
who knows?
So the latest from all of this is that we have claims from Terry McCoy that the trailer was featured on a clip in Bubba the Love Sponge's show back in August. And then after the temporary restraining order was put in place on September 4th, they still went ahead with the screening the next day in Tampa. And then the documentary was released to the public last Friday on Apple, Amazon, and Google Play. And Terry McCoy, the intrepid curator of the estate of Terry Jean Bollea, he sat down. I assume he purchased said documentary, and he screened the entire 3 hours and 10 minutes. Okay. This is a man that is committed to his case, and he time stamped all the instances of the sex tape making an appearance in this documentary. 17 examples of still photos from the unauthorized sex tape appearing, and one of a video clip, all eclipsing 8 seconds, which Bubba had claimed was edited out of the screening in Tampa, but which they had promoted would all be part of the documentary for the public. So I want to put my cards on the table. I have not screened the documentary yet.
You have timestamps to guide you through it, huh, though?
Now we know how to navigate through this. I mean, this is
and hyperlinks right in this affidavit.
Look at that. So spoiler alerts. Yes, I'm still amazed that this documentary is 3 hours and 10 minutes in length. But yeah, that is the latest. We also had Waltz Films responding to the suit last week. And yes, the case continues onward.
So there's
someone running the estate of Terry Bollea, which we did not when this lawsuit was still filed. They still had to finalize that. But now Terry McCoy has been appointed.
Bubba, which is his legal name. Bubba Love Sponge is his legal name, filed a filing last night saying that, well, you still haven't filed for the estate. You still haven't created the estate in the right way to make this lawsuit viable. They're having a hearing, I think, right now in federal court in Florida about this. So the documentary is on sale and they have not edited out any portions of the sex tape, which is Hulk Hogan's copyrighted work. So they're just going ahead with this, I guess, because they think they have a viable defense.
Well, if I get enough support, I will sit down and review this documentary in the future at some point. I mean, it sounds like something that would be categorized as a cruel and unusual punishment, but we will see if we have to deliver for folks. We have a slew of case updates, so I'm going to pass it over to you, Brandon, and why don't you take us through some of the updates over the last week. I believe we have updates on the Cody Rhodes, Wesley Icehold case. We have the latest when it comes to Liv Morgan's stalker. What's going on a legal front?
A lightning round, and then we'll get to a few super chats. So the Liv Morgan stalker case, the stalker, Sean Chan, the alleged stalker, Sean Chan, his attorneys had been trying to get him moved out of prison and into a Salvation Army to live. The judge ruled this week that no, he will stay in prison. The judge's order says that it's been learned that he has a delusion disorder and has a delusion as it relates to the victim, who is Liv Morgan, which the judge reasoned is all the more reason why this person should stay in prison and is a danger to society and the victim. So Sean Chan is staying in prison, who is a Canadian. So we'll see what plays out there. The W shareholder lawsuit, we had a number of depositions that are now scheduled. So this is the W shareholder lawsuit, which W itself is not a defendant in, TKO is not a defendant, but Vince McMahon, Nick Khan, Paul Levesque, George Barrios, and Michelle Wilson are defendants being sued by a class action of shareholders. And we have depositions that are now scheduled to take place for numerous individuals, including the defendants. Steve Coonan, who is a current TKO board member as well, already had his deposition. Today, Manjit Singh had his deposition. He is a former W board member. Jeffrey Speed, current TKO CFO Andrew Schleimer, is scheduled to be deposed. Steve Payman, Michelle McKenna, former board members, current TKO IR executive Seth Zaslow, is scheduled to be deposed in October. Alex Varga, who's a current W executive, Alan Wexler, former W board member, Michelle Wilson, George Barrios, Frank Riddick, former executives and board members. Paul Levesque is scheduled to be deposed on November 4th. Vince McMahon is scheduled to be deposed on November 12th, and mark your calendars, folks. And Nick Khan is scheduled to be deposed on November 21st. What does any of this mean? Are we going to get public records of these depositions? Not in whole. They may become excerpts may end up being a part of future filings as this shareholder lawsuit plays out. By the way, the shareholder lawsuit alleges that Vince McMahon just predetermined the whole TKO merger process because he knew that only his friend Ari Emanuel would allow him to stay with the company at the end of such a transaction. And so that's allegedly what he did. Defendants deny that. Okay. And then on to the Wesley Icehold and Cody Rhodes American Nightmare lawsuit over the American Nightmare trademark. They are still working toward a settlement. Basically, we knew this already, but their deadlines, which they asked for when they first let the court know that they were working on a settlement, came up, and they have asked for a further extension. They are still working on a settlement. So we'll see if that happens. In the Grant and Colker state-level case between Janelle Grant and Dr. Carlin Colker, there was apparently an error on the docket.
No.
And Dr. Carlin Colker has asked for a clarification regarding this. Janelle Grant's her attorneys filed a objection, essentially characterizing this or framing it as a way to delay producing discovery, producing the medical records that the judge earlier ruled that Dr. Carlin Colker must produce, even though he says he has produced them already. There's a dispute about whether they have been produced in full. And just an FYI, what's going on with the big federal case involving Janelle Grant, WB, and Vince McMahon? We're still waiting for Judge Sarah F. Russell to make a ruling on the narrow issue of discovery, that is motion-related discovery regarding arbitration. We're still waiting for that, and judges can take practically as long as they want. Similar.
Do you think she's been debating it and weighing this throughout all this time? Do you think that she started thinking about this months ago and she's just trying to arrive at a conclusion? Or do you think she'll just wake up one day and decide, I'm tackling this decision today?
It's a good question about how, I don't know, how judges, what their process is for making rulings like this. In the Ring Boy lawsuit, we're also waiting for the judge to make a decision regarding the motions to dismiss that case. Largely, the defendants are arguing on jurisdiction. There's jurisdiction reasons why this case should not be litigated in Maryland. These allegations are not viable outside of Maryland in all likelihood. So still waiting for the judge to make a decision there.
All right. Well, there you go. You are now up to date on all the legal happenings in the wrestling world at large. We'll end off here with a few super chats. Andrew Brown echoing the sentiment of many people. Loved Thurston's article about WrestleMania 43. Yes, we talked about this at the top, and you can still go read it up at postwrestling.com.
Thanks for keeping politics out of it.
Jake from the Windy City, rest in peace to legendary boxing and MMA writer Tom Gerbasi. His work giving attention to many fighters in the journeys was impeccable. Yes, Tom was a tremendous boxing writer and had gotten into MMA too. He wrote for the UFC site, for Ring Magazine. I mean, wrote many, many books on boxing as well. That news had just come out today that he passed away, so rest in peace. And Jared Clark.
Gerard.
Clark. I would love AEW, CMLL, New Japan, and RevPro to do an event in a rich sponsored country like Monaco, China, Japan, UAE, if possible, and Rio de Janeiro. I hope he means or, unless he thinks they should just blanket all of these various
countries. Like WrestleMania 2 is just be simultaneous in multiple
locations.
Yeah,
I mean, as many time zones as possible across, just put one promotion per country and cover every continent. I don't know. I think that there's certainly an opportunity for AEW to do something. I don't think it's going to harm WrestleMania. I think it's more so a PR exercise for AEW and just that portion of the calendar being able to be something that AEW can maybe capitalize on from just a fan in the US or Canada, for instance, that would make the pilgrimage to a WrestleMania every year that has just does not have the means to go to Saudi Arabia, but still wants to have that WrestleMania type convention experience and that you could stage something. I would certainly, like, you have enough time that I think you could weigh the options. And I, for many reasons, think that New Orleans would be a tremendous choice, if not Indianapolis.
Yeah. I mean, like, even putting the politics aside and the criticism of the Saudi Arabia events aside, it's still a longer and more expensive, at least air travel trip. I'm looking at New York to Riyadh is 12 hours. I mean, this is not going to London, which is a shorter flight, at least. So it's going to make it more difficult for people, at least on this side of the globe, to travel there.
And it's also going to increase, I think, a lot of the interest in next year's WrestleMania, just knowing that it's going, like,
it's your last chance.
That's it. That's how they should market it.
All further WrestleManias will be held in Saudi Arabia.
The real Double or Nothing next week, next year in April. In April. All right, we're going to close out the show here, but a big thank you to Robert for joining us. You can follow his work at The Uncrowned and many other outlets. Brandon Thurston, who is, of course, you can find his work at WrestleNomics.com, PostWrestling.com, and whatever else is in the pipeline that is coming up.
Yes, yes, it's all there. Every episode of Raw, SmackDown, NXT, Dynamite, Collision have the big data reports. I also put audio of the ESPN media call in there for subscribers as well, if you want to check that out.
Best media call you've been on in some time?
There, this was great. I mean, I think all wrestling media calls from now on should be with the TV executives of the partner. It was every question. I was listening to it, re-listening to it just before we got on the air here. Every question was a good question. No, nobody asked about when you're going to visit this town again. Nobody asked, you know, which match are you most excited for? There were no kayfabe questions. It was great.
It was kind of, you know, refreshing just on the sense of you're not speaking to the promoter. They're not necessarily like, certainly they have an investment. It's ESPN representatives.
Yeah.
But I mean, they're talking about things on more of a logistical level, and like the creative aspect and WWE decisions, like that's not their avenue. Right. And yeah, you did get a lot of like good questions out of this as well. So, I mean, it's you know, no showboating, no calling each other assholes. I mean, it was refreshing to hear. All right, we're going to sign off, but thanks to everyone for joining us. I'm back tonight with Wei Ting late because AEW is going on for 3 hours tonight in London, Ontario. September to remember. Will you remember this show by the end of 3 hours? That's going to be the challenge tonight. And then we're back, postwrestlingcafe.com on Thursday, as we are going to the state of Maryland, where WWE held the Survivor Series in 1995 in Landover, a.k.a. suburban Washington, D.C., as Vince McMahon identifies it on the show. So that is coming up on Thursday, and we will have coverage this weekend of both WrestlePalooza and All Out, which I will be attending and going to the press conference. So that'll be coming up this weekend. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. We'll speak with you next Wednesday, same time, 1 p.m. Eastern.
Fall calls for comfort. Mack Weldon's got essentials designed for cool days and timeless style. Their new Ace line combines comfort with sophisticated looks. Go to MackWeldon.com for 20% off your first order of $125 or more with code MACK25.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.